We will continue this morning in this Advent series where we have been in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 1, chapter 2. Matthew tells the Christmas story very differently from Luke. Luke is the one we typically go to, but we're listening this year to the way that Matthew tells the story. Remember, the Gospel of Matthew is, we'll call it the Gospel of Fulfillment. He's very interested in showing how Jesus is the fulfillment of all of the promises of the Old Testament. So in the first two chapters, we have several times where he says, this part of the story was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophets. You hear that again and again. What you notice when you go back to the original context of the prophets is that the prophecies were originally spoken to people who were either in exile or going into exile. So what we discover then is that Christmas is actually really good news for exilic people. And so we're going to pick up in Matthew chapter 2, verse 13. Remember, this is immediately after the three wise men, the magi, the three astrologers from the east, have come, found the Christ child, and worshipped him. Now when they, that is the magi, had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious. And he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping in loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. In my Bible, this section gets broken into two pieces. I think it should be read as a whole, but we'll deal with it in two pieces, one this Sunday, one next. As I read the story to you, did you hear echoes of another story you've heard before? Did you hear it? Did you hear a resonance with another story from the Old Testament, one that involves a young boy being born, one that involves the place of Egypt, one that involves an angry king killing Jewish boys? Did you hear it? Moses. If you heard it, I think you heard exactly what Matthew wanted you to hear. Matthew's telling the story in such a way that it echoes the story of Moses, and I think this would have been more true for Matthew's original audience if we assume that they're predominantly Jewish, predominantly first century Jews. They would have heard the resonance of the story even more clearly than we do today, because they were familiar with something that most of us are not. There was a tradition of interpretation that grew up around many of these Old Testament stories in the Jewish culture. It was like they filled in some details that Scripture doesn't give us. Most of us don't know any of that, but almost all first century Jews would have. You see it really clearly in the film The Ten Commandments. Who's seen this? By a show of hands. Okay, that's not bad. Jeremy's like both hands in the back. He loves the class. Listen, people, this is a classic film. Charlton Heston, it's like required reading. I mean, if you haven't seen it, we're going to have a watch party, okay? And it's, you got to come. It's that good. You just need to see it. There is a scene early in the film where Pharaoh is there with his advisors, and one of his advisors, or astrologers, comes in and says, "Mighty Pharaoh, your astrologers have found a star that foretells the coming of one who will be a deliverer." If I can use some parallel language, a savior unto the Hebrew slaves. Now, if you're like me and you watch this film and you're familiar with the book of Exodus, there's a lot of stuff in the film that is not in the book of Exodus. You're like, that's not in the Bible. And maybe you just assume that they're taking lots of creative license because it's Hollywood, they've got to tell a story. So they just kind of make it up. But they didn't. It may not be in the Bible, but it is in Josephus. Do you know about Josephus? Probably not. Josephus is, he's somebody that he becomes required reading when you go to Bible school. You remember Dave Smith told us, when you study the Bible, it is context, context, context. You do not interpret without knowing the context. The first step in biblical interpretation is understanding what the text meant to the people to whom it was written. We have to understand the text in the time and the period, the place, the historical context in which it was written. Josephus is very important in biblical studies because he gives us an incredible view into first century Judaism. So Josephus was a man probably born within a couple years of the death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus. He was born into Jewish nobility. His father was of a priestly family. His mother was a descendant of royalty from the Hasmonean dynasty, so kind of upper crust of Jewish society. He was eventually made the military governor of the region of Galilee, the very same region where Jesus did most of his ministry. Now, Josephus fought in the first Jewish wars against the Romans. It didn't go well for them. He ended up having to surrender. After he surrendered, he actually met Emperor Trajan. And when he met him, he told him that the messianic expectations that were fueling the Jewish revolt at that time, that the writings and expectations actually talked about Trajan being the emperor. Well, that intrigued Trajan. He decided to keep Josephus around as an advisor, as a historian, and eventually Josephus becomes a mentor and advisor to the emperor's son, Titus. He gets very chummy with the imperial family. He actually takes on their name. He becomes Flavius Josephus. And he is there as a translator in 70 AD when Titus besieges the city of Jerusalem and destroys it, including the second temple. So you might understand why he's not very popular among Jews, but his writings have survived, and it tells us so much about the times and the beliefs. And he actually gives us some pretty good insight into the Jewish traditions around some of these stories. He provides a very brief history of Israel, and he actually talks about Moses, and this is what he says. "Now it happened that the Egyptians grew delicate and lazy as to painstaking and gave themselves up to other pleasures, and in particular to the love of grain. They also became very ill-affected towards the Hebrews, as touched with envy at their prosperity. For when they saw how the nation of the Israelites flourished and were becoming eminent already in plenty of wealth, which they had acquired by their virtue and natural love of labor, they they thought their increase was to their own detriment. And having in length of time forgotten the benefits they had received from Joseph, particularly the crown being now come into another family, there was a new dynasty, they became very abusive to the Israelites and contrived many ways of afflicting them. For they enjoined them to cut a great number of channels for the river and build walls for their cities and ramparts that they might restrain the river and hinder its waters from stagnating upon its running over its banks. They set them also to build the pyramids. That's actually not historically accurate, but he said it was. And by all this wore them out and forced them to learn all sorts of mechanical arts and to accustom themselves to hard labor. And 400 years did they spend under these afflictions, for they strove one against the other, which should get the mastery. The Egyptians desiring to destroy the Israelites by these labors, and the Israelites desiring to hold out to the end under them. Here's where it gets interesting. While the affairs of the Hebrews were in this condition, there was this occasion offered itself to the Egyptians, which made them more solicitous for the extinction of our nation. One of those sacred scribes, who was very sagacious in foretelling future events truly, told the king that about this time there would be born a child to the Israelites who, if he were reared, would bring the Egyptian dominion low and raise the Israelites. He would excel all men in virtue and obtain a glory that would be remembered through all ages. Which thing was so feared by the king that according to this man's opinion, he commanded that they should cast every male child which was born to the Israelites into the river and destroy it. Now you might think, okay, RJ, that's a really interesting meandering through history. What's the point? I want you to hear this with the ears that Matthew's audience would have heard this. They had a telling of the story of Moses that included many of the exact same elements in Jesus. Are you hearing it? One who is to be a deliverer, whose birth is foretold by a star, the news is announced by the astrologers. And the king is so anxious to maintain his position that when he finds out about the birth of the child, he executes Jewish boys. I think Matthew, when we read this, wants us to hear echoes of Moses. What he wants us to see is this parallelism where Jesus and Moses are of the same type, as if Moses prefigures the Messiah who is to come, so that whatever it is we think about and associate with Moses, we begin to think about and associate with Jesus. Well, when we think about Moses, what do we think about? Well, we think about the Exodus. And the Exodus is like the great act of salvation in the Old Testament. Like salvation par excellence. This is the great thing God has done to deliver his people. And then God takes them out into the wilderness and takes them to his holy mountain. And he gives them the law, the Torah, the Ten Commandments, instruction on how it is you're supposed to live if you're in relationship with God. Because what he's doing at the mountain is he's confirming the covenant, this relationship-bound, this promise-bound relationship that begins with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's at Sinai. It's with Moses that you find out. It's not just Abraham. It's for all of Abraham's children. Everybody gets in on this saving relationship. So it's Exodus and salvation. It's instruction for how to live. It's covenant. And it's God with us, isn't it? Isn't that the promise of the covenant? I will be with you. I will be your God and you will be my people. That's why the story of the golden calf is so significant. Moses is up on the mountain getting the Ten Commandments. The people get tired of waiting, and they make a golden calf. And God is so angry, he says, "Stand back, Moses. I'm going to annihilate them." And Moses says, "You don't want to do that. Those are your people down there." He says, "Fine, I won't wipe them out. But you're going to take him and go to the promised land, because if I go with you, you will be destroyed on the way, because I'm a holy God." And Moses says, if you're not going to go with us, then don't send me. If you're not going to come with us, don't send us at all. And God relents. And this is the amazing story of Sinai. The God of heaven comes out of heaven onto the mountain, and the mountain shakes and trembles, and there's lightning and thunder, and he gives the law, and the people tell Moses, "You talk to God, not us." That God comes off the mountain and into the camp, and he moves into the tabernacle. It's literally Emmanuel, God with us. And then God takes them to the promised land to deliver and make good on what he's promised to give them. But they don't believe him, which is insane. Haven't they seen enough signs? I mean, if God can part the Red Sea in two and just walk you through it and wipe out the army of the greatest empire on earth, what are a couple fortified cities? I mean, really? But they refuse to believe, and so they wander in the desert for 40 years until another generation grows up that will choose to believe God. That, in a nutshell, is the story of Moses. So now we have another whose birth is foretold by a star, whose coming is announced by astrologers to a king who in his anxiety decides he should kill the one sent to save. If Moses is the key figure of the Exodus, the great act of salvation in the Old Testament, well, we know what Jesus represents, don't we? It is the great act of salvation, not just for Israel, but for all the world. He is the one who will establish a new covenant. Just as Moses was the key figure in the old one, Jesus is the key figure in the new one. Are we then surprised when we jump a couple chapters ahead that we find Jesus wandering in the wilderness, not 40 years, but for 40 days? Only unlike the story with Israel, Jesus doesn't give in to temptation. And then in chapter 5 of Matthew, we have the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus telling us how we ought to live in the kingdom of God. It's the new ethic of the new kingdom. It parallels the Torah. When you read the story, Matthew wants you to hear Moses. But then he goes on to say this. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." Now that prophecy comes to us from the prophet Hosea. Comes to us from Hosea chapter 11. Let me read it to you in the original context. "When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt I called my son." This again is where Matthew, at least at first glance, seems to be taking phrases from prophets and using them quite differently than the original context. Matthew is saying that this passage is speaking about Jesus, the incarnate Son of God, who had to go to Egypt to avoid being killed by Herod. But that's not what Hosea says. It's actually interesting, is it not, that Matthew calls this the fulfillment, as if like there was a promise made, but in Hosea, the verse isn't looking forward, is it? It's looking backwards. It's not promising anything, it's remembering. It's remembering Israel's history. When Israel was a child, I loved him. Out of Egypt, I called my son. The more they were called, the more they went away. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning offerings to idols. Yet, it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them up by their arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of kindness, with bands of love. I became to them as one who eases the yoke on their jaws, and I bent down to them and fed them. They shall not return to the land of Egypt, but Assyria shall be their king, because they have refused to return to me. So verses 1 through 4 is recounting history. The focus is looking backwards. I guess if I'm on the stage, backwards is probably over here for you guys on a timeline. He's looking backwards. It's not till verse 5 that you get the turn and the look forward. And what's prophesied is not the coming Messiah, but exile. You look back to the Exodus, the great act of salvation, which is followed by cycles of sin, and then he turns and he looks forward to exile, the great punishment that would eventually bring Israel back to their God. So what in the world is Matthew doing here? We talked 2 weeks ago about a way of interpreting Scripture called sensus plenior. It means a deeper reading of the text, but I wouldn't blame you if you thought, well, that's a cute Latin phrase that means Matthew's making it up. I would get that. What is he doing? Are we supposed to think of Jesus as being in parallel with Moses? But when he starts quoting Hosea, now it seems like Jesus is being set in parallel with Israel. Is Jesus the Son? Is Israel the Son? Are we supposed to be thinking about Exodus and salvation or about exile and punishment? Yes. The answer is yes. All of it. At the same time. Here's what I think Matthew's doing. I'm going to read it to you from the New Testament scholar, Donald Hagner. He says it better than I could. Matthew sees Jesus as living out and summing up the history of Israel. Jesus is the embodiment of Israel, not only anticipating her victories, but participating in her sufferings. All the history of Israel, and Matthew has been alluding to it the whole time. You remember how he began the book with the genealogy, Abraham, and the promise. David and the promise, the exile, which is the problem, and the Christ, the solution. Understand that as a good Jew, as you heard the names being read, what came to mind was story after story, history upon history. Now he's telling us about the birth of Jesus in such a way that you can't help but think about Moses and all the great acts of salvation that went with the Exodus and the law and the wanderings and all that history. And have you been listening to the prophets he's quoting? One of them talks about the city of David. Now one of them is talking about Egypt. And then we read one that talks about Ramah, and there's this exilic context. It's like the history of Israel painted in the color of geography. It's the whole story, the whole thing, crammed into two chapters, finding its focus in Jesus. The whole purpose of the history is in Jesus. I think a little bit this way. Do you guys know what string art is? Yeah, if you got kids, you've done this. You take a board and you hammer nails in it, and then you take string and tie one nail to one nail, one point to one point, and if you zoom in real close, it doesn't always make a lot of sense, does it? And you begin to scratch your head. You're like, how does that connect to that and that connect to that? But when you step back and you see the whole picture, it all begins to make sense. Everything that it means to be Israelite, the history, all of it finds its focus in him. Let's say this another way. We spent several months talking about exile, and we've said that, well, exile is actually not a bad way to talk about the human condition. Because from the very beginning, Genesis, Adam and Eve are exiled from their home in paradise. And what they're really exiled from is that intimate presence of God. And so exile is so much more than where you happen to be geographically at any moment. There is a very real sense in which being human, there's just something about it. If you're quiet long enough, you hear it in the recesses of your soul. There's something where you're never quite home. Hear the good news of the incarnation, of this Jesus, the Son of God, who took on flesh, who became man, who entered into our experience. Let me use the words of an old hymn. Christ, who left his home in glory. If I can use a biblical word, to come down and sojourn among us exiles. Born of a virgin and then has to flee the country of his birth because his life was in danger. Can I tell you, I think Jesus knows exactly what it's like to live in exile. Brené Brown describes the difference between sympathy and empathy this way. She says, if you can imagine falling into a hole, into a pit in the ground, sympathy comes by and says, how you doing? That looks terrible down there. Can I get you a sandwich? See you later. It's well-meaning. It doesn't usually help. Empathy comes by, sees you in a hole, finds a ladder, and climbs down, and sits down beside you. It's not a bad picture of the incarnation. Jesus showing up and being with us in the condition we find ourselves in. It's this part of Advent that takes us to a paradox that is at the very heart of our faith. We talk about it in Advent because, well, Jesus came, and our hope is that he's going to come again. And when he comes again, everything gets set right. Everything that makes you sad, that hurts you, that makes you angry, that's broken in the world, the injustice, the tornadoes, the bad government, all of it gets set right. And death is undone. The problem is we're still waiting for it, but this is the paradox. Jesus is with you while you're waiting for him. Do you know this? We're waiting for him to show up to fix it, but it doesn't mean you're alone. Jesus is with you in every situation, even as we wait for him. Which is why we light a pink candle. Understand, we don't have a pink candle up here because I goofed up. I know it looks like I ran out of purple and grabbed the next closest thing. We did this on purpose. It's a different color on purpose. And I know it's asymmetrical, and it bothers me too. It is what it is. It's meant to catch your attention. It's meant not to make any sense. We can have joy in the waiting because the God we're waiting on is with us while we wait. And I know that sounds nonsensical and paradoxical. It's the faith. It's the faith. That's good news. And here's one more bit of good news. I want to believe that Jesus can do for each one of us what he did for Israel. I want you to think about your past. I want you to think about, the part of your past you don't want to talk about. You don't have to talk about it, but I do want you to think about it. I mean, in a room like this, there is plenty of past. There are plenty of parts of our life that we don't want to relive, and we would be mortified if somebody could relive it with us. We would feel incredible shame. There's things behind us that we like to keep behind us. And in church, we say, past sins confessed are forgiven. That's true. You're redeemed, but it's still there sometimes, isn't it? Jesus takes all the history of Israel. And he enters into it and he gathers it together and becomes its fulfillment, its telos, its perfect, its climax. And he redeemed. Do you understand how ugly the history of Israel was? I mean, it's bad. I mean, really bad. So the prophet Hosea, the primary metaphor to describe the relationship between God and his people Israel in the prophet Hosea is that of an unfaithful spouse. Not just one who had a little fling of romance, one who has sold themselves repeatedly to people who never loved her in the first place. And she did it again and again and again. It's a story of a people that saw with their own eyes the incredible miracles of God and yet couldn't believe. It's the story of the people who, when they're standing at the base of the mountain where the God from heaven has descended upon it and the mountain is covered in smoke, they get the bright idea, why don't we make an idol? What? It's people who God said, listen, if I'm going to live with you, this is how you should live. And it starts with just treating each other decently. And they couldn't do it. It wasn't just that they treated other people wrongly. That would make sense. That kind of tends to be human nature. They treated each other terribly. Like their own tribe, their own people. And just this cycle of sin again and again and again, and until their own leaders are practicing child sacrifice. I mean, it's just terrible. And Jesus gathers it all up. And in ways only God can do, he redeems it. And so it is the story of God with his people. In all its messiness, its brokenness, but redeemed and beautiful. So what I want you to hear this morning, as we continue to wait in a broken world where tornadoes rip across the country and devastate lives, in a world where we do really, really dumb stuff, in a world where most of my problems are self-inflicted, in a world where it just seems people can't get along with each other, hear the good news that Jesus wants to take your story and not just the highlight reel, all of it. And in a way only he can do, he's going to gather it together and he's, well, like Hosea, he's going to buy it back. That's what the word redemption means. He'll redeem it and he will become your life's fulfillment. And your life, all of it, will become a spotlight that shines on him and tells his story and is for his glory. That's a good Christmas story, isn't it? I want to close this morning by reading the rest of Hosea chapter 11. They shall not return to the land of Egypt, but Assyria shall be their king, because they have refused to turn to me. The sword shall rage against their cities, consume the bars of their gates, and devour them because of their counselors. My people are bent on turning away from me, and though they call out to the Most High, he shall not raise them up at all. Except when you get to verse 8, everything turns. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my burning anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not a man. The Holy One is in your midst, and I will not come in wrath. They shall go after the Lord. He will roar like a lion, and when he roars, his children shall come trembling from the west. And they shall come trembling like birds from Egypt, like doves from the land of Assyria. And I will return them to their homes, declares the Lord. Hosea is a homecoming story. It's our story. Coming home to be with God, who buys us back and draws all that we've been, our history, our story, into his story.